I wrote that script before the show ever went on the air. Before any of the executives, and I'm purposely not mentioning any executives' names, had established the characters. And my script went a long way to establishing those characters. And I wrote what I thought was a dynamite script. Really a dynamite script. Then, as happens in television, it's the old French joke about the chef who has made a great soup, and all the other chefs come in, they say, well, we must make it just a little bit better, and they all piss in it. Everybody pissed in my script. When it came time for the credit, everybody vied to get the credit, but I wound up with a solo credit on it because it was my story.
Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I am the host, Terry DeFellin, and I'm joined by Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And Derek Mantle.
Hello.
How are we doing, chaps? All right?
Yeah, we're fine.
Good. It seems like ages since we were last around this table.
It does.
Well, not for you, it might be, but I just jumped through The Guardian, and I'm here right from the last podcast.
Wow. So for you, amazing. Time has hardly moved on at all.
Yeah. No. Whereas the rest of us have just sat here.
Yeah, just getting older.
Just getting older. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, indeed. In our last podcast, we discussed the episode "The City on the Edge of Forever," and this podcast we're going to discuss the Teller play, originally submitted as his final draft of the same episode, "City on the Edge of Forever," by Harlan Ellison. This episode was heavily rewritten. It's fair to say from the original draft that was submitted by Harlan Ellison. And a great deal of rancor and controversy and feuding and fussing has gone on since then. The original episode, or the original teleplay, I should say, has been published on a number of formats. Most recently on Skyboat Media as an audio presentation, a sort of essentially a script reading, but also by IDW Comics as a graphic novel. Or a mini-series that was then collected as a trade or as a graphic novel, which we have on our table here. And it's immaculate, I have to say. The presentation is absolutely immaculate. And I know you guys have had a look at it. You've got a copy, I've got a copy. Graham, you've had a good look at it.
Yep.
And it is, it's absolutely gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's the other format. There is a motion comic version, which is quite good as well.
Yeah. Based on the same artwork.
Yeah. The only thing is, as you mentioned, that the sound effects do get a bit grating after a while.
Yeah, I don't know how successful that format is going to be. I think it seems a little bit quirky.
I think it's from Madefire, so.
I mean, the episode, the teleplay differs quite drastically in some way. So I will just forewarn you. If you're not familiar with this teleplay and you'd like to be familiar with it before somebody tells you what happens, then we should issue a spoiler alert and perhaps discourage you from listening to this episode. But I mean, it is essentially, in terms of the story, it's not too different. You know, what happens in City on the Edge of Forever teleplay is pretty much what happens in the aired version. So you're not missing much, but there are some significant differences, at least for me anyway. Essentially, chaps, what happens is that I think that there's a scope to the episode and a dimension to the episode that I think is not in the aired version, which I think that Ellison is something that he objected to. There's two characters in there. There's an extra character in there that is conflated into Joan Collins' character, Edith Keeler. There's a chap in there who puts Kirk and Spock up in when they first arrive, and he essentially becomes Edith Keeler. McCoy is not the guy who runs amok. It's a guest star character called Beckwith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Beckwith. Yeah,
who's a drug dealer and a wrong'un, and he's a member of the crew. So you can imagine how people at Roddenberry Towers would object to a character like that. There's an additional character called Trooper in there, who I think does survive. He becomes that kind of like homeless, kind of hopeless hobo guy who ends up zapping himself. Yeah. And there's, I mean, the tenor and the cadence of the episode is different. There's a political dimension to me missing. There's a, when Kirk and Spock arrive, the first thing they're confronted with is a political rally. And there's a sort of, well, there's a right-wing political activist making a speech.
Basically Trump rally.
Yeah, it's a, yeah. And Spock is recognised for being a Chinese and a foreigner and an immigrant, and they attack him, and Kirk and Spock have to run away. And there's a, this undercurrent runs through this episode. And it's that subtext is, for me, is mm-hmm. completely missing from the aired version. And I mean, things like, you know, the original confrontation with the Guardians of Forever is very different, and also there's a odd subplot with space pirates as well.
Yes,
which is odd to say the least.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get to the nub of it then, Graham. I know you've got a strong opinion about this story. Tell us your impressions of this story, please.
Okay. Well, It's interesting that we've got it in front of us in a graphic novel, because having listened to a read-through of the script, it's actually reading the teleplay, so with all the directions mm-hmm. and everything else on there as well.
Indeed.
And also looking at this graphic novel, this makes a brilliant graphic novel, and it would make a brilliant film, a brilliant standalone one-off episode.
Right.
But as part of an anthology series, as a regular episode of Star Trek in the 1960s, it just can't fly.
Okay.
There are so many things in this episode.
Okay. Well, what within specifically, what leaps out at you as elements that you think just wouldn't fly in the
character of Beckwith, although it's strong, and yes, he's a drug dealer, and Ellison says, well, you know, surely 450 people, one of them's bound to be a runner.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're in the space. You're out there on the final frontier and everything like that. You're in a very, very crazy place, and crazy things are going to happen. But really, if you want someone like that in, for my mind, that's a character you build up. Mm. That's a character you have around. You don't just parachute him in, because it's completely going away from everything you've ever seen in there before, which doesn't mean necessarily it's a bad thing. It's just very difficult to get through in 3/4 an hour. The thing I find as well about this is that Ith Killer doesn't turn up until the end of Act 2,
mm-hmm.
which in the aired version, in the aired version, that's when McCoy comes back into it at the end of Act 2. You've barely got any, even in the graphic novel, she only appears in the second half of it.
Mm.
So you've got this, the main central character. So you've got this love that's meant to build up really in about 10 minutes.
Mm.
And it just doesn't work.
We saw in the last episode, we talked about the very few scenes that little screen time that Joan Collins and DeForest Kelly had to develop a relationship. Could you not make an argument that in fact with just good screenwriting, good direction, good editing, good acting, that you could develop a similar...
No, because I think as well, is because we know so much about the stories now, we know that DeForest Kelly did actually ask for a love interest to be put in there,
right.
And Joe Pevney wanted that as well, and they actually shot an extra scene that developed that out a bit more,
right.
That wasn't used. And I think perhaps knowing that, we see it a bit more than we actually would do or just on view.
Right.
He does care for her, but then he's a doctor. And he does try and save lives, and so this is, and he's a hero as well. So
I mean, you know the script. Then are you unconvinced by the relationship between Kirk and Keela in Ellison's teleplay?
No, I think the thing is, I think he makes it fine,
right?
But I don't think he's got time for it.
Okay,
there are so many things. Sorry, Derek, I'll come back to that. But I think that he's got so many things in here. The space pirates. The space pirates are a great idea, and let's face it. It really looks at, someone saw that idea and thought, well, mirror.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because Ellison refutes this in Ellison's essays.
Yeah.
He says that there had to be a sequence in the plot in which the Enterprise was in peril.
Yes, and I know. Yeah.
And he then subsequently wrote it in with subsequent grasp, because although that's his draft, it's not the first draft.
No.
There are many other drafts. This is the one, and this is the one that he claims was the one that is with all the advice that he took from Roddenberry and from right. Justman and anybody yeah. else who was giving him advice. And that he claims to have added the space pirates in,
yeah,
bit, out of and says that they were a terrible idea.
Yeah, well that's yeah. that. The, but that's one that. Of the reasons why it is a terrible idea and it doesn't.
Yeah.
And what they finally end up in the aired version where the communicator just goes dead and the ship disappears. That's much much better than
yeah.
than space pirates.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and no. so you can take that bit out. Let's yeah. get rid of that bit.
Yeah.
And. And yeah, I do think that LeBec and Beckwith are extra characters that you don't need.
No.
They are extraneous for it.
Yeah.
And I think really, once you get rid of those, once you get rid of the space pirates, you've essentially got the same episode. Yes, Trooper is the big difference.
Yeah.
Trooper really is a way of hitting the morality button and saying, look, this is what we do. This is the message. And this is when you start really like finger wagging and browbeating and say, right, this is the message of this episode.
Yeah.
Is that missing from it? Yes, it is. But let's face it, where are you going to fit it in? What fat are you going to trim from yeah. that 45-minute episode to fit in something and make it really believable yeah. and
something well, yeah, that we can... You'd have to rewrite it.
Yeah,
you'd have to rewrite it. Yeah. I'm conscious you've not said much, and you want.
Sorry,
to...
No, I totally agree where yeah. Graham's coming from the case of it being a Star Trek episode point of view.
Yeah,
but there are a couple of little things. Is that I feel that Harlan Ellison wasn't writing for Star Trek here.
No, he wasn't.
He was world building. He was building a science fiction series.
But he does get it right because he really does pick up the characters and he picks up how the characters were meant to be built up. Like the character of Rand, he really does go with it. And obviously, like, it doesn't really work out, the character of Rand.
Because she gets dropped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From what she was meant to be, he goes with it and goes really...
Well, he's basically layered up even more information behind the whole thing and the whole story, the characters, and the case in point. I actually, about the things going a bit too quick when they're in the depression Earth, I actually feel that the case with Spock and Kirk, they've been on this Earth. You don't actually... I felt when I was listening to the audio and reading the comic strip was that they've actually been on there for ages.
Yeah, they've
been
there
for months.
Yeah, you know, my impression waiting, is that they've.
But that's easy to get across in prose. And this is what another thing is as well is that Ellison for me relies a lot on the direction, the prose that he's writing in there, and the points that he's given to the directors. Which makes it, I mean, most teleplays are really dull to read.
Yeah.
But this is amazing. He writes it like a book.
Yeah.
I mean, and it is written like a book. And because he's such a great writer, it comes across the way. And no wonder it wins.
Well, this is probably the way things are written now. Because it's like, I take a little bit of a detour here. The case about writing is, going back to one of our other loves, is comic strips. During the sort of like the whole of the comic strip industry until the 1980s, most comic strips were written in a sort of really cut down way, plotting, and it was the Marvel way, or you know the old fashioned way of just doing quite a simple sort of script for an artist to follow. Then Alan Moore comes along and he writes a bloody novel on one to describe one page.
Yeah,
and it seems very similar to Harlan Ellison's way. In fact, there is a relationship towards Alan Moore and Harlan Ellison because Alan Moore actually ripped off quite a lot of Harlan Ellison's work.
But I think that goes back to my original point. It was that time as well when comic companies were bringing out one-off graphic novels based on stories that weren't canon, but they were based on stories of their main characters. So they would have... Batman stories or imagined Superman stories, not the one where he dies, but ones where he dies, you know, in other versions of it or something like that. And so you get people allowed to mess around with the characters, actually like really open up, use it as a sandbox and really try and go something out. This is what this strikes me. It strikes me as the best fan fiction I've ever read.
I could probably concur. I mean, there's a lot of things in there. I mean, you're talking about the two characters who weren't needed, Beckwith especially, because you know. But the interesting thing, the way it starts, it starts bringing into a sort of more realistic idea about being on a long haul, you know, sort of you know, sort of tour of duty on a starship, you're going to have like psychological problems, you're going to have all of these things, drug problems and bad ones turning up, other cases where they've done you know, they've had like special missions which have gone completely wrong, which we don't know about, and things like this. There's all this sort of layering that's been put in there, which is great if you're writing a story in a novel form, but for TV doesn't actually work because it's just too much. You have to cut away and get to the gist of the story.
Of course, now we live in the age of downloading and box sets.
Yeah.
So the idea of story arc is fine, and you know, and you can have great story arcs for entire seasons. Because people, that's how people consume it now. They don't consume, and back when Star Trek was on, they didn't show them in order. They didn't show them in production order. They didn't even if like there wasn't an episode, they'd slot in reruns in there.
It's one episode though, anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, this episode is a standalone episode. It could sit this teleplay could, had it been,
this teleplay can't, well, I mean, this teleplay isn't a standoff, one alone. This teleplay that Harlan Ellison wrote, It strings in so many things that it would look completely incongruous if it was.
Well, it affects everything afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way they can walk away from this.
It's quite funny because obviously Harlan Ellison also was very good in his, you know, he worked in science fiction before in The Outer Limits, and he's done, you know, two very good Outer Limits episodes, The Demon of the Glass Hand and Soldier.
Mm.
Both of them, again, to do with time paradoxes, which is funny. But they obviously were one-offs, and obviously he got to a certain position where, you know, he is a master of his craft in doing one-off episodes. But with the Star Trek thing, he's come into this situation where they're doing an ongoing series, and they obviously have a Bible as well, and he's working with other people like Roddenberry and taking direction from them and so on. And he's added more to the characters and the world, which could have quite a dramatic effect for them going further on if it wasn't an anthology series as it is.
I mean, perfectly, because I think he's quite critical of anyone who rewrites his stuff, and you know, he's quite protective of everything he writes, but he plays fast and loose with what anyone else writes.
I'm going to say it's
just getting back to what you did. What aspects of this episode do you think would there's no walking away from that are different from the aired version? I mean, the aired version ends very powerfully. I mean, this one ends very powerfully as well. I mean, what elements of the teleplay would you say are irreconcilable for an anthology? Why can't we just go back on to, what is it, Simon Earth, which is the next episode on from there? What particular are you thinking about with the teleplay?
I'm thinking about the guest stars in here, about what's going on below decks.
Right.
What's actually how he can't trust his crew, because this is where this whole thing comes from,
and they don't have as much respect for him.
I see what you mean. So he introduces that element that because the crew's not essentially perfect not disciplined, that this then plays into the next episode, and you think that is something that would future
well, it weakens
showmakers
Kirk.
It
does weaken Kirk quite substantially. And
the whole episode weakens Kirk essentially because Kirk is willing.
Mm.
Kirk is willing to give it all up. He's willing to watch all these people. He's willing to let all these people never exist.
Yeah.
And he's willing for them, or many of them, to die, conceivably including himself, because of his love for Edith Keeler. Because he doesn't make the choice in the end. In the aired version, he makes the choice to stop Bones from saving Edith Keeler, from saving Edith Keeler's life. In the teleplay version, it's Beckwith. In the big switcheroo, that's the big one of the twists in the tale. Yeah. Is it's Beckwith, despite the fact that he's an evil, corrupt, drug smuggling villain who doesn't know Edith Keeler from Adam, but elects to save her life or attempt to. And it's Spock who intervenes.
Mm.
Kirk just stands there.
Yeah.
So we're left in the episode. Episode finishes, and Kirk has effectively decided that his own personal feelings are of a higher priority than than all of those people who are going to die.
Yeah, but Kirk doesn't do anything.
Yeah, well, yeah, but he's because he's unable to act.
Yeah,
and I would interpret that to say basically he is unable when the time comes. He does nothing.
Well, that's So he does nothing to either let it happen or not let it happen.
No, but in the air version, he's the hero. He intervenes.
Yeah, but he doesn't.
Edison's version, he freezes.
Yeah,
presumably because he's paralyzed and he doesn't know what to do.
Yeah.
So he make you. So if you were
well,
to
that is a presumption, isn't it? You don't know that.
No, no.
Or whether or not he's actually saying that. Actually, I'm not going to stop this from happening.
He's the captain and supposed to be the guy. And the story's leading up to.
Yeah.
The reason why he has these arguments with Spock during the teleplay about his relationship with Edith Keeler is that he is getting close to her so that when the time comes, he has to act because he recognises that he's in charge and he has to do it. But when the time comes, it's not him who acts. He is paralysed and it's Spock who acts.
I don't read that at all. I think at the for a writer, you've got to look at that and say, well, he's got to do either two things. He's either got to stop it from happening or he's got to let it happen. And the thing is, through inactivity, he's not letting either happen.
Yeah, but
he's actually divorced himself from making the decision. So what that actually is, I think that's the weakest one of the three things. It's like whenever you come up, you've got well, do one thing, do the other, or actually make no decision at all.
He does nothing.
Yeah,
he completely freezes.
So in which case, but then that's taking him out the equation, and really that's really unresolving.
But it is to underline your point about how this undermines Kirk. This episode undermines
it. Does yeah.
It, it fatally undermines him because in the moment when he has to make the big decision that's going to save millions, billions of lives and change it, he freezes.
I don't think that's a decent ending.
I didn't actually see it the same way as either of you actually.
Oh, right, okay.
I saw a narrative that was building up as it was going along. I saw a period of time things were going. I saw that the relationship to Spock and Kirk was sort of like fraying at the edges.
Mm.
I mean, it frayed right from the beginning when actually the Spock was when he was attacked. And the when they escape and have the conversation about the Spock was just totally disgusted with humanity and what was happening.
Yeah.
And he's trying to bring himself down. There was from the teleplay some of Kirk's sort of like concern. There wasn't as much concern for Spock in what we usually get from Star Trek in this. They seem to be different characters. And as the thing goes along, over the months that they were working and trying to build stuff like this, the relationship between Spock starts to disintegrate.
Yeah. Well, he becomes this, in the end, he's this shadowy figure.
Yeah, on the stairs.
Who is watching Jim Edith together because he's worried about what's going to happen.
It's even more of a melodrama. It becomes in that sort of feel. And that's why I get through the whole thing. And then as the conversations with Kirk and Spock about knowing that what he has to do, I feel actually Kirk's actually lying a lot of the time.
I get that.
Do you know what I mean? There is that relationship.
Again, because I don't think he comes out of this well at all.
No, yeah, but in the teleplay, he also explains about how time is drawing these people together, and this is why Beckwith goes and saves him, because he doesn't actually do this from any sort of... This isn't down to the fact that he's a morally complex character. This is actually the fact that time is leading his actions.
I found that
and then Spock says, "Oh well, maybe time's doing the same thing to you." And I think this is the thing about Allison, is he plays around with these ideas, which he's not really thought about what they're actually doing. He's just saying, "Well, okay, these are things." He's not actually putting the story about this is how it goes and this is what is happening. It's just saying, well, look, this is happening. What do you think about it? It's like, you know, this is...
Mm.
So it's not... I think it's a bit of a cop-out. I mean, I'm sure, you know, if he was here, he'd be very angry, throw a few cups at me and call me an idiot for not actually getting what he was actually going on about. But
he probably doesn't care anymore.
He probably doesn't
he care. He may not care. I mean, yeah. I mean, he should. I mean, what he should do is, like all artists should do, is he should allow people the opportunity to assess his work in their own way and interpret it in his own way. Yes. But, I mean, we get the impression from Ellison that is not, you know, how it is. He means things to be a certain way, and if you don't get it, then you're an idiot.
Yeah.
My feeling about it is that it's written very early in the run, yes, even though it's aired very, very late. Yeah. Because it's something like 10 months late. And as a consequence, the original dialogue in there is not consistent with some of the characters. And some of Spock's dialogue and Spock's reaction, for example, after being attacked when they first arrive, is way more human than we're used to with Spock. If this final draft had been taken and put on the set and said, we're going with this draft, Nimoy would have smoothed out a lot of that dialogue.
Yeah, he would have.
There and then. And I doubt very much that Ellison would have disagreed with that, because, you know, the characters have moved on and they're well-established characters by this point. And much of the dialogue is not consistent, to my mind, with how the characters. There is stuff that says that both Spock and Kirk say that are not necessarily things that they would say, that you would expect them to say. So I think that stuff like that would get ironed out, definitely, in there. I wanted to talk a little bit more about Spock in this, because there's a dimension to this this script this teleplay that for me was taken out, and that is the backdrop of the fact that it's pre-war. There's a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment going on, very prescient themes for all times. All this is a disease that all mass societies has, and Ellison's making a specific point about this, and for me it's removed, but. But Spock is often used as a vessel for that, and his arc in this is very interesting, because he's attacked for being Chinese as soon as he arrives. He ends up getting a job as a pot washer overnight when he's, like many immigrants, frankly, massively overqualified to do a job like that. But he ends up doing it because it's the only job that immigrants are likely to get.
He does a whole week of it, doesn't he?
Yeah, and then his boss tries to stiff him out of a buck. Out of it, because he thinks that the guy is stupid, and he's going through an experience that I think a lot of immigrants go through, is that they're exploited and they're underestimated and they're assumed to be idiots and they think that they can take the piss out of them, and they end up kind of living in the shadows. And even Kirk, when Kirk moves into his new apartment near Edith Keeler so that he can be with this girl that he wants to hook up with, right, ultimately, he says to Spock, you know, keep yourself, you know, out of the way, and you know, and Kirk is settling into this life quite comfortably. Yeah, he's the white guy living in America at this time, and Spock is the immigrant who by the end of it, yeah, he's this almost menacing figure who's standing in the background looking around, you know, and that's a really interesting arc. A lot of this is portrayed because of the graphic novel.
Yeah.
And this is the skill of the Tipton brothers who adapted the novel, and obviously of the artist who made it all work. It might not have come through in the audio rendition, and it might not necessarily have come through.
Yeah, it doesn't really.
Yeah, I think for me that comes through a lot stronger in the graphic novel, and I would assume that it would probably come through quite well in the episode, but we don't know, because this script was adapted by two guys who know Star Trek very well, and they're also extremely accomplished comic book writers. So you have to be careful about getting too carried away with the comic book, because it is intended to be a comic book and not a replication of a TV show. The TV show, you know, even if they'd done this faithfully, it would have been probably very different.
Well, the director's going to get hold of it, and no matter what it says on the directions, which are very, very exacting.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I mean, that whole opening, not the opening sequence, the sequence on the city on the edge of forever itself, which I would like to just talk about. I mean, that is hugely ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not if Ellison insists that it could have been done, well, I don't think that's for him
98
to say.
98 cents was his famous quote. He used to tell the producers, you could make this episode for 98 cents.
I think the thing is, in fairness, a lot of people said a lot of things over the last few years, and maybe a lot of it is just being said off the cuff.
Well,
Roddenberry said that this episode would have cost $360,000 to make by the time he died. I mean, he was estimating that upwards throughout the years.
Oh, yeah.
Such was the rancor that, frankly, by which point it's just.
But this episode, descending. The actual episode, did cost more than it should.
This episode went way over budget. It was always going to be an expensive episode. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
But there were themes in the episode, and themes don't cost money necessarily.
No,
they can do.
This is being made in the mid 60s, and civil rights is a big issue at the time, and networks might have got a bit sniffy if you put something out that was so not just alluded to, but really just.
Oh, yeah, it's very on the nose. It's unambiguous.
No, exactly. And when Star Trek usually do it, there is some ambiguity there. There's an alien race or something.
Star Trek says these aliens are, all right, they're us. But they're aliens, and so that's how
we get this arms race between these aliens is very similar. But
Roddenberry would look at that script and go, "This is not what we do.
Yeah.
We don't criticise ourselves. We criticise alien species. Yeah. We get to go on primetime TV by criticising ourselves, but using alien races as surrogates."
Yeah.
We don't do it ourselves.
Yeah.
And we certainly don't do it in a time period where most of the audience were there at the time all probably have a degree of complicity in those years where some deeply unpleasant stuff went down.
Yeah, and especially when you're coming up to the end of a series and you don't know what slot you're going to get for your next series, if you get another series at all. And what the last thing you want is advertisers phoning up and saying, we don't like the show.
This is what I think about this teleplay. Is that I think it is a shame that it wasn't used.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't accept that it was impossible to make, because I think ultimately when you get a script, turns up on set, and the director looks at it, the editors look at it, the physical effects guys go, and they say, no, that won't work, that won't work, that won't work, that won't work, that, and they just change it. And then if Harlan Ellison or any script writer says that, and he says, come on in, you tell me how to do my job. And then end of story. Not even Harlan Ellison is stupid enough to tell a physical effects guy how to build the Guardian of Forever. I mean, you just don't tell people their jobs, right? No, you just don't do that.
He does throughout the whole script. He tells the director exactly what to do because he
can, and that's what he wants.
Yeah.
But I think if he's got a brain in his head, and he's written tons of scripts that have been turned into TV shows and into movies. He knows how this works. I mean, his essays and the narration in his essays are really rancorous.
Yeah.
And he's clearly very embittered. And I think it's important to just bear in mind that he was at one stage, you know, a very competent, extremely accomplished, but professional man.
Yeah.
And I think that if they had taken that script and made minor adjustments while maintaining the integrity of the script, then I think that he would have complained less.
Yeah, but I think, as I say, the elements in this that they took out, there was probably reason to take them out. At the time, they probably wouldn't.
I agree with you. I mean, I think where I'm disappointed is the character of Trooper.
Yeah,
this is the source of disappointment biggest source of disappointment for Ellison. Rat becomes Trooper, doesn't he? And there is room in the story for Rat. And if there's room in the story for Rat, I think there could have been room in the story for Trooper.
Well, of course.
And I think that's a shame, because he was one of the most poignant. I mean, it's beautifully, the script is beautiful. I mean, the exchange between Kirk and Trooper, which I acknowledge realistically may not have happened, but it is a glory. It's a lovely little scene. And in the end, when he dies, And he's been completely disintegrated. There's just a whiff of smoke from where this guy used to be. The whole thing about Trooper is he's a beggar. He fought with Verdun in the First World War. Mm. And Kirk doesn't know where Verdun is. Mm. He asks Spock, where is Verdun? And that's his, and it's beautiful. Wasted, frankly, on network TV.
Yeah.
The trouble with this script is it's too good.
My
opinion is it's too good.
It's years ahead of its time.
Too nuanced. It's too in, but it's also too on the nose.
Yeah.
And it's completely inappropriate for primetime TV on the network.
But does that mean that sort of, I mean, you've actually said
it's
to me
still
once,
shit that it didn't get yeah. get put on. But it is.
You're saying that there might be a case of one of the reasons why it was altered so much was is that it would have actually put everything else to shame around it.
There's an element of that.
I don't think so. I think there are elements there that you just can't use. There's so many elements that you can't use.
There's a lot of
and he's such an explosive character, Ellison, that he could protest to say that, you know, never ever let your stuff be rewritten. And really, I don't think there is. I don't look at that at the City on the Edge of Forever. I don't think anyone else does and thinks, wow, this that could have been better, couldn't it?
No, I mean you can only do that if you watch it through a filter. So yeah, if you become aware of the arguments and the rancor and the and what Ellison has said about it, and then you then watch it again through that filter, then you could conceivably allow yourself
I think Bob, to
get caught up in that. But you don't want to do that.
No, I mean the interesting thing I think about listening to Ellison's diatribe was actually the bit about. From what he read in Inside Star Trek, the book by Bob Justman and Herb Solow, and he refers to that a couple of times, and actually he doesn't really, he only disagrees with one thing.
No, he only refutes one thing, an anecdote in a bar.
Yeah, an anecdote in a bar, which neither of them were involved with, but it is repeated there. And I think, actually, when I read it back, I thought, well there's no need for this to be in this chapter here. So you can get rid of that. And he does go on and on and on about the fact that, like, you know, he doesn't drink and blah, 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 blah. And so, fine, take that out. But the rest of it, everything else that Justman says, he's fine with, even though he calls producers all manner of names and says they're incompetent and hardly fit to do anything and they've got no imagination and whatever goes on and on and on and on. But all the things, I think Justman actually summed it up perfectly with a series of memos between the two and saying about, goes through scene by scene about how much things will cost. And the fact that it goes an extra 2 days filming, and all the time he's saying, oh, it's going to cost nothing. You've already got this stuff lying around. You've got these clothes, all this and that. You know, this crowd scenes. You don't need that big a crowd there to do this. And really making excuses for something that will cost lots and lots of money. And Justman does. He costs them all and says, look, you know, that's going to cost twice the normal rate. That's going to cost three times the normal rate. And he goes, all of these things, once you cut them out, and you've cut a lot of this out and you've still got something that's a third over budget.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I don't doubt for a moment that as a teleplay, he could have squeezed all of that into an episode. I don't doubt that one would. I mean, it's very dense. There's a lot going on and there's probably too much going on. And also, I think that the teleplay suffers because I think the characters have moved on by the time he's finished it.
Yeah.
The characters have now moved on.
Yeah.
And that, I think, also accounts for some inconsistencies. And I also, yes, I think that you got a lot of extras going on. There's at least two, three public meetings going on there which require extras. There's a whole ton of stuff going on there. And there's lots and lots of scenes. And every time you have a new scene, you have more money. And all adds up. So I completely get that. What's the shame for me is that there are themes in the episode
that have gone.
Yeah.
I think it's a shame that those themes have gone. But I'm not really going to argue with the decision to take those themes out.
Yeah.
Because, well, I mean, it wasn't my cock on the block at the time. I mean, you use a decision. And also, it's forgivable because it's such, the Erd version is such a good episode of Star Trek.
But do you think that sort of Harlan Ellison also disagreed with the person who rewrote or who took...
Well, it was rewritten, he says, by four different people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Dorothy Fontana, Gene Roddenberry, Stephen J. Karabatsos, and Gene Kuhn. Okay. That's who he says.
And who's on the...
Harlan Ellison is the name on the script.
Oh, okay.
And maybe that pisses him off as well, because he feels that they were trading off his name by putting him on there.
Well, he has in the past suffered a fit of pique sometimes, because I don't know if you know...
Cordwainer Bird.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Cordwainer Bird
that's his pseudonym, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. When he's to mark his disgust with... With the final
he wanted to do that for this, didn't he? He wanted to add his pseudonym
yeah,
to
yeah.
this.
Because he edited it.
He was effectively told that, you know,
you won't get paid.
He was threatened you'll be blackballed if, he,
oh,
if
really?
He did that. Yeah. He said, we will see to it that you will never work again if you do this.
He did it on the Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea episode.
Right.
That they use something because he has a low opinion of Irwin Allen. As do you, Terry.
I haven't a low opinion of Owen Allen's TV shows only because I think that 50 odd years later, I don't think they're very watchable.
That you have.
Well, I don't. If you want to class that as a low opinion, then by all means do. I mean, you know, he knew more about making TV shows than I do. You know, you know, I'm always reluctant to be too judgmental about this. We've talked about this for quite a lot.
We have,
And it's now coming up for 2 o'clock, so we should be going for some beer and some football quite soon.
Yeah, should indeed.
I'll sum up there. Is there anything you want to say in summary? Is there anything you feel has been unsaid? Graham, do you like the teleplay?
Oh yeah,
I love it as a single work.
And I think, as I said in the previous episode, about how the similarities there are between elements of The Voyage Home and City on the Edge of Forever.
Yeah.
And actually looking at teleplay, there is even more. There's even a discussion about Iowa in there.
Yeah, the Iowa thing was great, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Which immediately takes you back to a similar conversation.
I'm from Iowa, I only work in outside.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you also get the female characters are very sympathetic.
They're decent.
They're a sucker for lost causes.
Yeah.
And
this just goes to show that they knew how to write female characters back in the 1960s. Yeah. It's just they were prevented from doing so. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I actually liked Yeoman Rand's character.
Rand is, you know, great.
Unfortunately, it's in a really, really throwaway part of the plot. Throwaway part of the plot.
Yes.
Because they did throw it away. And unfortunately, it did give you an idea of what they thought of Rand and about where they thought that character was going to, and maybe Grace Lee Whitney wasn't up to it, or maybe the writers didn't fancy writing that role.
Well, they'd kind of written her out of the show by that point anyway. So, yeah. I mean, it was effectively Uhura who was the female member of the team that went down, the female member of the landing party, wasn't it? Which was quite strange in itself as well, really, in a way, because, she didn't do anything.
Yeah, and it was only really until about Mirror Mirror that we really saw what that character could do. Yeah,
exactly. There is some humour in there. The thing about the trucks, the prohibition.
Yes. Truck. Yeah.
You know, I didn't realise trucks like that were illegal in there. That's funny. And I think it's a very mature, very grown up, very, very packed script. But perhaps by the time it arrived on the desk, my concern is that they might have looked at that and gone, initially thought, it's very ambitious, it's very good. And also maybe deep down that this is now become a show for another series. Mm.
Mm-hmm. And also, one thing before we go, I was just having a quick flick through the graphic novel, and I remembered something from listening to the teleplay. It was the costume they had for Edith Keller, which was meant to be a cloak and a clasp,
and the clasp,
which was meant to be a cryptic clue
from the garden,
and that all gets taken away from out of it. But in the actual aired episode, instead of a clasp, she's wearing a fob watch, which I thought was really, really interesting with the whole time travel thing.
Oh, I didn't realise. I actually thought of a nurse. You see, when I saw.
Yeah,
the fob
I
watch.
Thought I was thinking nurse. But I didn't put that together at all.
But you've read another thing. Oh,
There's so much in there.
But I was say. I mean, there's one last thing. I mean, I did mention to you before about this, but. This idea for this story that Harlan Ellison did have an original story that he had touted around called Man Without Time, which was about someone going through time against an adversary where he was trying to put time back together and he ends up in the becomes friends with Abraham Lincoln and he's not supposed to save, he knows that Abraham Lincoln's got to die.
Yeah.
And so it's the same situation of Kirk, you know, if Abraham Lincoln stayed alive, it would have actually caused a completely different outcome to the world and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, but Harlan Ellison said that he was touting this around with some plots and stuff like this, and it ended up at old Irwin Allen, and it ended up as the basis for the time tunnel. You know, so but Harlan Ellison does like his time stories.
Yes,
as I was saying. So
I think, in respect of Ellison, I think the criticisms that he got, that he was undisciplined and that he was perhaps suggesting that he wasn't competent, I think are extremely unfair for a man who has done the amount of work and produced the amount of work that's been turned into stuff. Is very unfair. And I can understand Ellison being unhappy, because he may well have lost work as a consequence of being slagged off and badmouthed for a long time by quite powerful people who accused him of such things. So you can understand why he was there. But television is a collaborative medium, and it is a medium riddled with compromise. Any kind of collaborative creative work is about compromise. This podcast didn't necessarily would have gone the way that the three of us imagined it would have been at the beginning, anything like that. And if you don't acknowledge and embrace that, then you're likely to get upset. And also, you're probably in the wrong business. You should be writing novels. Even when you write a novel, your editor is suggesting
someone's got to sell it.
Yeah,
someone's got to someone's got to print it. Someone's got to put it on bookshelves and hope that someone walks out of the shop with it.
Even down to the relationship between the creator and the audience, there's a there's an element of compromise in all of these things, and you have to wonder if Ellison perhaps is too protective of his work and doesn't acknowledge that to a certain degree, after a while, it needs to move on.
Yeah. I think it's an indication of how he lives his life as well. I think he's one of those...
A man of conviction. And a man of profound ethics. I mean, he's turned down money to not put his name on
And a man of his time as well. The mid-60s, you know, very much in that Southern Californian culture. And I think as well, not really down with the whole, well, with the essential commercial aspect of television.
He doesn't like the man. And, you know, and who does? Who likes working for the man? Hands up, who likes working for the man? No one's raising their hands here. No one likes working for the man, and he's no different. And yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, his cultural and political background do reflect that.
Unfortunately, the man is cutting the checks on this
program, and well, he's not cutting the checks on this show.
No.
Which is why we can say these things, I suppose.
Yeah.
Let's draw a line under that. And stop. This has been a really interesting discussion, and it's nice because we've had a slight divergence of opinions, which is also great, because we don't normally, we usually passionately agree with each other. It's nice that this, and it's a testimony to the work, that each of us, three of us, have been able to get something different and see different things out of this work. And it further underlines how massively inappropriate it is for primetime TV, frankly. That'll be that. That's the last word on that. Thank you very much indeed for listening to this. We're back next month. Next month, guys, is our 1 year anniversary.
Oh, wow.
And for our 1 year anniversary, we will be talking about the episode of which this title of this podcast is inspired.
Hey!
And that is none other than Whom Gods Destroy. And I had to say that out loud slowly, because I might say Whom Pods Destroy by mistake. So until then, from myself, Terry DeFellin, from Graham Sibley, and from Derek Mantle, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.